Deze podcast is mede mogelijk gemaakt door Hendrix Gin en Pimenton.
Hendrix Gin is een gedestilleerde Schots gin met een kenmerkende infusie van rozen en komkommer. Probeer nu ook de fruitige variant Grand Cabaret.
Pimenton is dé webshop voor foodies. Ze hebben meer dan 1000 ingrediënten van over de hele wereld die ze snel en voordelig versturen vanuit België.
Ook bij ons geldt geen 18, geen alcohol. Jeroen, welke van onze 77 plus afleveringen vond jij het minst geslaagd?
Ja, dat is een gewetensvraag. Het is een beetje een vraag welke van je kinderen je het leukst vindt. Of het minst leuk eigenlijk. Dat is,
Zeg maar niet.
Nee. Ik vond aflevering 3 vond ik het minst geslaagd. Dat heb ik ook wel gezegd bij taco's. Mexicaanse keuken, dat onderwerp was te groot. En we wisten er eigenlijk te weinig van af. En als ik daar nu naar terug... Ik kan die niet terugluisteren.
Nee, echt waar?
Nee, kan ik echt niet terugluisteren.
En gaan we wat aan doen?
Daar gaan we wat aan doen. Wij gaan revanche nemen, ja.
Ja, want we gaan namelijk een bonusaflevering opnemen. En we hebben zo een interview met Rick Martinez. Foodies die de Amerikaanse markt, foodiemarkt in de gaten houden. Die weten waarschijnlijk wel wie hij is. Hij is een jarenlang reclameman geweest. Heeft anderhalf jaar voor Bon Appetit gewerkt. En is uiteindelijk van New York naar Mexico verhuisd. En de reden waarom we met hem praten is dat zijn kookboek Mi Cocina is net in Nederland verschenen.
Ja, en daarmee hadden wij de kans om hem te interviewen. We hadden gehoopt dat we dat zouden doen voor de taco-aflevering. Maar we kregen de bevestiging dat we mochten interviewen op de dag dat de taco's uitkwam. Toen dachten we, ja, gaan we het dan nog wel doen? Maar ja, we wilden jullie niet onthouden, dus wij doen een bonusaflevering.
En de bonusaflevering is niet in het Nederlands, maar in het Engels, hè, want hij spreekt geen Nederlands.
We kunnen ook Spaans praten. Zullen we dat doen?
Hablamos español.
Sí, cuando quieres, hombre.
Een lege koelkast. Weer zonder warme maaltijd naar bed. Ruim 450.000 mensen in Nederland zijn in voedselnood. Het Rode Kruis geeft boodschappenkaarten aan mensen die dit het hardst nodig hebben. Geef jij iemand voor 6 maanden een steuntje in de rug? Je wordt al vanaf €3 per maand boodschappenmaatje bij het Rode Kruis. Ga naar rodekruis.nl/boodschappenmaatje.
So, good morning, Mr. Martinez.
Good morning.
What did you have for breakfast today?
Well, today's breakfast was a little boring just because I was rushing. So, coffee, yogurt, and granola.
So that's a typical American breakfast. It doesn't sound like a Mexican breakfast, right?
No. Normally, I would be sourcing some fresh mangoes or some papaya, fresh coconut. And then
sounds good.
Actually, yesterday, if we'd recorded yesterday, I had a very, very good breakfast. I had refried beans, chicharrones, chorizo, some really beautiful blue corn tortillas. It was a very, very good breakfast.
Great. And do you make those corn tortillas yourself?
Those I bought locally. I don't usually make tortillas just for myself, mainly because I would eat them all and I would be very, very large if I did that. But I love blue corn tortillas. Blue corn is actually one of my favorite types of corn. It has like this really intense nutty, earthy flavor that you just don't get in the other colors.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's your choice of tortillas if you buy them yourself and eat them yourself.
Yeah, that's the main one. I mean, I typically like the darker colored corn just because I think the flavor is more intense. Yellow corn is also really, really good and can also be very nutty. Mm-hmm. White corn, I just don't like. In America, the equivalent would be sliced white bread. It's just boring.
No taste.
And we know American bread.
No taste.
No.
Yes.
We stay away from American bread.
Yes. Hey. Unfortunately, I think all of the world knows American bread. Yeah. And it's not good.
Hey, Rick, we are very honored that you made time for us to talk to us about what you do and where you live in Mexico and, of course, your cookbook. But how did an ad man end up in food?
Interesting question. So I have always loved to cook. So my love of food came from my mother. When I was really young, my mom used to pick me up from daycare. So I was probably around 3 years old. And we'd come home, she would go to her bedroom and change, and I would pull up a chair to the stove, and I would climb on the chair, and I would just stand there, and I would wait for her to come, and we would start cooking. And she would just tell me, you know, to stir this pot or to do this. And she would just kind of walk me through every step that she was doing and why she was doing it. Occasionally, I would taste things, but I was, you know, I was just really interested in what she was doing in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And I think so, you know, she passed on a lot of technical knowledge, but I think probably the most important thing that she passed on was why she did it, and which is, you know, she cooked to express her love. I think that the biggest insult that you could have ever paid my mother is to not like her food.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because it came from a place of love. Like she cooked for her family, she cooked for her friends, not many other people, like for neighbors, but it was a special gesture. Like yeah. if you know, we grew pecan trees and peach trees growing up. And so, you know, she would make a peach pie or a peach cobbler and give it to a neighbor because she really loved that person.
Sure.
And that was something that was really important to me. And I actually grew up thinking that everybody did that and realized that, no, that's not true.
Yeah.
So that love of food, the love of cooking was always with me. And I tried, while I was in college, I interviewed with the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park. And I wanted to go to culinary school, but my parents were like, no, get a real degree. Don't be a cook. You know, just do this. If you want to cook later, you can do that some other time. So I did, you know, I talked to the people at the CIA and which is the Culinary Institute, and they, you know, they were like, well, you know, let us know when you're ready. And okay. So I went to, I got my degree at the University of Texas, and then kind of randomly stumbled into advertising. I was actually going to go backpacking through Europe with some friends. We all graduated. And I had another friend who was working at an advertising agency, and she said, do you know anybody that needs a job that can speak Spanish? And I was like, all right, well, I can speak a little Spanish, so sure. I applied, and then I got the job, and that was sort of how my 16-year track in advertising started. And then it ended similarly, like, you know, I enjoyed advertising. It was very lucrative. It got me to New York. I started in working in Dallas and then eventually moved to New York with the agency. Made a lot of money, you know, had a very sort of Mad Men, you know, New York lifestyle. And I enjoyed it. But, you know, there was a point where I was sitting at my desk thinking about food. Thinking about what I wanted to cook, what I wanted to eat, the parties that I wanted to host, the menus that I wanted to create. And everything that I did, I would take classes, I would throw dinner parties, I started food photography blog. All of those things I did to try and like make this yearning go away, and it didn't work. And so finally I was like, you know what, I just need to do this. And yeah. And so, you know, it took a long time to decide to do this, but finally I was like, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to go back to school and I'm going to just see what happens.
Yeah. And that turned out pretty good, right?
Yeah. It's pretty much the best thing I ever did.
And so you went back to the Culinary Institute of America, or did you start working right away?
No. So I decided, there were three schools that I was looking at. CIA was one of them. The French Culinary Institute in Manhattan was another, and then Le Cordon Bleu in Paris.
Yeah.
And I took classes at all three of the schools just to make sure that, you know, I really wanted to go there, and also to decide which one I liked best. And, you know, I really wanted to move to Paris, and I really loved Le Cordon Bleu, but, you know, I knew that if I went there, my trajectory would have been very different. You know, the people that went to that school went into fine dining in French restaurants.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go into food media. I had no desire to open up my own restaurant. And I really wanted to work in, you know, in television. And so I just decided that it was probably better for me to stay in New York City and go to school there. And the other thing too is, like, you know, and I love CIA, but it's in the middle of nowhere, you mm-hmm. know? And so on your off time, you're basically in a forest. And that the problem, I mean, I don't mind, you know, being isolated, but I like being stimulated. I like being inspired, and the restaurants in New York City inspire me, and I get new ideas when I go out to eat there. And so I wanted to be in an environment where I could learn at school, but then go out to a restaurant and see what all of these amazing chefs were doing.
But right now you're not in New York, you're in Mexico, right? That's where you live right now.
Yes. Yes.
So you went to Mexico for a few weeks to do research for your book, and now you ended up living there permanently. How did that happen?
I mean, it was honestly a pandemic move. I mean, I came here for the original plan was going to be 9 months of research. So okay. I bought a car in October of 2019, and the plan was to drive around all 32 states to visit as many cities as I could. And then I was going to go back to New York.
That's for the cookbook. Was that plan already there? Or?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
So
yeah.
Basically a road trip.
It was a road trip. Yeah. And in fact, the book itself was going to be positioned more like not a travelogue per se, but it was going to be more about traveling and eating. Okay. You know, and so this was 2019. So this was pre George Floyd, pre all of the riots in the United States.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so I started in October of 19, and then by the beginning of March of 2020, the pandemic started and was moving across the U.S. and it hadn't really taken hold in Mexico at that point, but I was supposed to go back to New York to shoot some videos. All of my videos got canceled, and you know, and I was in the northern states in Mexico, driving across the desert, and I was like, all right, well, I can either go back to New York and sit in my apartment for I don't know how long, or I can just stay here. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know what, if I'm going to have to quarantine somewhere, I want to be by a beach. And so
good tortillas.
Like I said, and so I was in the middle of the desert, and I had a friend that lived there at this, the town was called Torreon. And he was like, why don't you just stay here? Like, we have a big house, we have a big kitchen, we can cook together. And I was like, you know what, I need to go to a beach. And so Mazatlan was on my research list, but I was only probably going to be there for 24 hours. And so I was like, well, you know what? I'm just going to go down there. It was an 8-hour drive from where I was. And I decided, okay, I'll go to Mazatlan and then, you know, start writing the book. And then when the pandemic's over, I'll just start traveling again. And then I got there and never left.
Do you think that staying in Mexico actually helped making the cookbook? Do you think, or would it be the same if you would be in New York?
No, it's, I think, you know, and I didn't fight with my publisher, but my publisher wanted the book faster.
Oh, okay.
And their position was, why don't you just write the recipes in New York? And also, why do you need to travel? And I mean, but you know, if you look at other Mexican cookbooks, these writers, I mean, they may have a connection to Mexico. They may have lived there. They might be from there. But, you know, as far as I know, no one has actually traveled to every single state.
Sure.
To taste the food.
Yeah.
And to me, that was an important thing. And even, you know, and part of this was based on, you know, I grew up with Diana Kennedy, who was a British woman who lived in Mexico and studied the cuisine. And her book, My Mexico, she admits in the introduction, she only traveled to 17 of 32 states. So it's like, well, how is it that you're representing a country if you only visited half of it?
Yeah.
You know, and by her own admission, she said she only visited the places that she liked. And I'm like, well, okay, I am not doing that. I'm going to visit every state, and I'm going to try and show like the country as best I can in you know, 300 pages. So that was very important to me. And the, like I said, the publisher, they wanted the book a year earlier than it came out. And I was like, well, sorry, it's impossible because I'm not going to do that. And so, you know, and so part of, part of the journey was, you know, a self-exploration. I was also looking for, you know, where my family came from. And so that was another reason why I didn't want to cut the journey short.
All right. Then actually what started off as just a Mexican cookbook turned out to be a very extensive deep dive into Mexican food and also your personal roots and heritage. How has the let's say, the extensive travel changed your perspective of Mexican food and Mexican cuisine?
Oh, God, in so many ways. I mean, even, you know, even the cook that I am today is different than the cook that I was a year ago when I was writing recipes for the book. I think the biggest thing that has changed, you know, I explored the country. I tasted so many dishes. I became very familiar with flavor pairings and combinations and also balance, how people create balance in dishes, which I think is really important in any cuisine, because I think in any cuisine, you know, there's sort of an ideal perception of, like, you know, so for example, in like Vietnamese cuisine or Thai cuisine, when you're making a sauce, you know, there's a level of acidity, there's a level of sweetness, there's a level of, you know, of an amount of fish sauce that you're going to use. And that's a very important ratio. And if you don't get it right, it's awful. It's either too sweet or too acidic or too funky. And a lot of cooks, a lot of home cooks there and other places, they just know how to do this because it's all the way that they were brought up eating that particular dish or that sauce. And I think that's true in Mexico. And so I was aware of those things and I was learning methods as I was traveling. And when I started to write the book, I was trying to understand why people do the things that they do, because to me, some things seemed unnecessary. And I would try and not do them to see what would happen as an experiment, and then realize, no, actually, this is a critical component of the flavor. And so you have to do this step. Whereas now, you know, I don't have to think about cooking anymore, about cooking Mexican food. I can improvise, right? It's like, I guess it's almost like an actor. You know, you're learning your lines and you're learning the character. And I was in that stage of development. I knew my lines, but I don't think I was fully the character a year ago. Whereas now, I feel like I can fully improvise, right? I not only can I give you my lines, but if you told me to create a scene without a script, I could totally do that because I understand the flavor. I understand what it means to be a Mexican cook.
So what you're basically saying then is that to properly understand a kitchen, a cuisine, you need to train your palate and align your palate with the local palate, and that takes time.
Yeah, it definitely does. You know, like, it's not only... Because I think what people do, you know, and I'm guilty of this as well. Like, I think you are always trying to make something good to you, right? So I might read a recipe from someone in Italy, and then I think, well, that's hard to find, or I don't want to use that, or I have this in my pantry, and so now I'm going to do all of these things. But there's a lack of finesse and a lack of understanding and almost therefore respect of that cuisine. When you learn those things, when you actually learn why things are done and what things have to be done, and then what things you can shortcut, you know, then you're treating the cuisine with respect, and then you can insert yourself into that. You know, and then, like, no, I don't want to use plantains in this mole. I'm going to use a peach, but I know what the plantain does. It adds acidity and it adds sweetness, and it's typically roasted. So I'm going to roast this peach. So I'm going to insert this ingredient in a way that is respectful of the dish and does the exact same thing that the plantain does. Only it's something that I can source locally, or that I like better than a plantain, or whatever. Yeah. And then I think that's a better way to cook a cuisine.
Can you give another example, which is really Mexican, that you have learned to master and to now easily use?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, you were talking about tacos. I mean, one thing, you know, and I did this probably most of my culinary professional life. In the U.S., balance is something that's very important, right? And I think balance is important in every cuisine, but I think it's treated differently. In the U.S., Americans love balance in every dish, right? So if you make a stew, or if you make an entree or a side dish, each component has to be perfect in and of itself. Even though nobody's going to just sit there, I mean, probably somebody will, but like if you make a side dish, if you write a recipe for a side dish, you as the writer are intending it to be eaten with something else. And probably not a lot of people are going to sit with that bowl of, you know, green beans and just eat them by itself. But you have to make it perfectly balanced and, you know, the textures, the flavors and all of that. And I tried to do that, or I did that with my Mexican recipes pre the book and pre the research. And, you know, and what I found once I got to Mexico and started exploring is that a lot of these dishes are not balanced, you know, and so
the separate dishes. Yeah.
Correct. Especially I think with tacos. So if you went to a taqueria and you tasted a lot of the different taco fillings, they would be very, very delicious, but they would play heavily in one space, either very meaty or roasted vegetable or, you know, some particular area. And on their own, while delicious, they need something else, right? But it's because in a taco, a really good taco is a layer. It's just layer upon layer of flavors. So you have, you know, your first layer is this hopefully really good corn tortilla that is going to give you not only a way to carry all the filling, but also it's going to give you a nice corn, nutty, toasty flavor. And then you're going to have your principal filling. And then that's going to give you maybe something meaty, something saucy, something roasted or something charred, something smoky. And then you're going to have, you know, probably some fresh cut vegetables that are going to give you crunch and freshness. You're going to have some salsas and maybe some that are creamy, some that are acidic, some that are really, really spicy, maybe some that's made with oil and dried chilies. And then you're going to top it off with herbs and a squeeze of lime, which is going to provide you that acid that's going to cut through the richness of everything. And so
sounds
now,
fantastic.
Yeah. And now your taco is perfectly balanced, but you know, the Mexican palate is, I think, trained to understand there's always going to be fresh herbs and fresh vegetables on the table. There's always going to be salsas. There's always going to be lime juice or lime wedges. And so if you're cooking a dish and you know that that's coming, you know, that's always going to be on the table, then you're not going to like make anything overly acidic. You're going to make a dish that is going to then be dressed. And that is, I think, a big thing that I've learned.
So in Mexican cuisine, you create more tension between the components of the dish instead of trying to balance them in every component individually, right?
Yeah. And I think the other thing that's really interesting too is that you're creating these bold components knowing that there's someone else that's going to be creating the harmony, right? Yeah. So like I'm out of the picture, right? I'm going to make you my 10 components and then I'm going to pass it off to, you know, all of my guests. And it's up to them to create the harmony in their taco. Yeah.
Interesting.
I think that's really cool because, you know, then you as the eater can then experiment like, okay, this taco was really spicy. I want this one to be a little sweeter. So I'm going to use this sweet salsa.
In that sense, your cookbook is called Mi Cocina. And it's not sort of, I mean, it could have also been something like an introduction to Mexican cooking, but you make it really personal. Why did you choose that title?
Because it is personal. I mean, you know, like these, I also, I mean, this is something that, you know, there are a lot of Americans and foreigners that have been accused of going to Mexico and either taking recipes from people or going to schools and you know, taking classes, taking all the recipes, and then going to open up a restaurant in the U.S. or whatever. And I wanted to be very clear, because I am a recipe developer, right? And so my currency, the way that I make money, the way that I make my brand, is my recipes. So those are very important to me. And so I didn't want anyone to believe that I traveled around Mexico and I wrote down exactly, you know, what all of these people were doing, and I published someone else's work. These recipes, all of them, are, to me, they're love letters to the people that cooked for me on my trip. Because everybody that I talked to, and I would say probably almost 100% of the recipes in the book, someone made and I had a conversation with them about it because it was so good, you know? And like, either I had the conversation before, like, what is your favorite thing of everything that you cook? And then they'd said, well, this, you have to try this. So then I would try it. And I'm like, sure enough, this is amazing. And then we would talk about it. And so I had a very personal relationship with each cook of every recipe. And so, you know, to me, when I sat down to write the recipes, I would think about that person and, you know, and I asked them, like, why do you make it this way and not this way? Right. Because I would have already tried like probably several versions of this dish. And I knew the differences in, you know, in the recipe. And this particular person made something that I thought was really outstanding. And I would try and understand why they did it. And they would just simply say, because this is the way I like it. And I love that idea, right? Like, I think that Americans have this very strong belief that there is one correct way to make any dish. Mm-hmm. And so you're always searching for books or recipes that are authentic or real or genuine. Yeah. And it's like, no, I mean, the reality is that, you know, you could invite 10 people over to your house and ask every person to make the same dish. Every dish is going to be different. And probably every dish is going to be good in some way. And, you know, and in Mexico, people celebrate those differences and learn from each other, which I also think is really cool. So that to me is what I wanted to do, is like, I learned a lot from all of these people and all of their delicious food. And I wanted to make a recipe that I could make in Mazatlan that a home cook in the US or in the Netherlands could make, hopefully, using ingredients that you could source locally with no special equipment. And, you know, and that is a very different recipe than the actual thing that I ate in the field. And the other thing too is that, you know, you can't, I don't believe that it's possible to recreate food in any foreign country, because, you know, there are certain things, the terroir of a place creates the flavor. And so there were recipes that, or things that I ate that had five ingredients, but those five ingredients were, you know, like a freshly slaughtered chicken, corn that was growing in the field, a cheese from a goat that they just milked. And it's like, well, I mean, no one, unless you have a farm and you're raising and growing all those things, is going to ever be able to create this dish, sure. You know? So I'm just not even going to bother to think about writing that recipe.
Rick, talking about the Netherlands, your cookbook is translated in Dutch and it's going to be available in shops when people listen to this podcast. For most people, Mexican means Tex-Mex. You know, the hard shells, the beans in there.
Burritos.
And for instance, in Holland, I think there are a couple of shops that are really good sourced for Mexican ingredients. We also have, there is a company who imports the Mexican...
the corn and the nixtamalization.
Sure.
And
make them themselves, really? but also the peppers. Well, I always forget the names of the correct
the peppers. The Guadillo peppers and peppers. Yeah.
So the ingredients are pretty good to find here. But if people buy your book, what kind of recipes do you think they should try if they want to go away or stay away from the Tex-Mex?
Start exploring.
The real Mexican food.
Everything that you just said made me so happy. Several years ago, I was in Amsterdam. This was probably around like 2006 or 2007. And one of my friends asked me to make a Mexican dinner for everyone, for all of his friends. And I combed the city trying to find any Mexican ingredients. And I was just like, I'm going to have to improvise. Like, I literally, like, there was nothing available. So it makes me so happy now that these ingredients are now available. I think there's a dish. So one thing that is, to me, is very comforting are guisos, which are stews. And they can be made with vegetables or with animal proteins. There's one that I had in Michoacán, in Urapan. We were finishing up a photo shoot for Day of the Dead, which is in the book, the photos from the essay on Day of the Dead. And we had driven to Urapan because there is a market that it's called a Mercado de Antojitos, and they only sell like small plates, like appetizers, kind of like like Spanish tapas.
Sure, yeah.
And one of the dishes was the morisqueta michoacana, which is a stewed pork and charred tomato and guajillos, and it's served over rice and beans. And it's just a really, really simple dish, and it's so good. It's so comforting. And especially like as you're going into cooler months and wintertime, to me, that is just like, it's just like a hug from your mom. It's like, so warm and comfortable, and it's really easy. But I also think that it, you know, that recipe is a good way to introduce you into basic techniques. And so, you know, if you decide to make the beans, you know, I have a really simple frijoles de olla recipe. It's like five ingredients. You basically throw everything in a pot and just simmer it until it's cooked, and the beans are tender. If you can make it over white rice, or there's an arroz blanco recipe in the book, which is actually my favorite rice ever. And like that rice, I distinctly remember the day that I had that rice. I was in Durango, and I had ordered these sweet tamales, sweet enchiladas. And they're like very common there. And I tasted them. I didn't really like them. They were actually really sweet, even for me, and I love sweets. But they were served with this rice. And I was like, oh my God, this is insane. It was like buttery. It had lots of vegetables in it. And so I was like, this is going in the book. that's the rice that I make most often. But then the morisqueta, you know, it just combines so many flavors. And again, it's a really simple dish to prepare, but I think it's just very emblematic of what I believe is Mexican comfort food.
I'm taking down a morisqueta and arroz blanco. Those are the two we need to make. And
yes,
arroz blanco, it sounds just like plain white. I mean, the name suggests to me it's plain white rice, but it's not.
Yeah. No, it uses a lot of butter, or my version uses a lot of butter. I think a lot of people aren't aware that butter is used a lot in Mexico. And the reality in the northern states, there are a lot of cattle ranches and dairy farms. And in fact, there's a large Mennonite population that makes a lot of cheeses in the northern states as well. So cheese, butter, beef, cream, a lot of those things come from that area.
And sounds so all familiar rice, to us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah. I mean, this sounds great, especially the arroz blanco. I'm really curious about after it. Yeah, yeah.
You're going to love it.
We just did an episode about tacos, which was actually the reason for reaching out to you initially. Are there any tips you can give us for when you're making tacos or when you want to get started with tacos?
I think, you know, so like if you can't find good tortillas, which at least, you know, in the U.S., it's very easy to find bad tortillas. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say probably most of the tortillas that you're going to find at the grocery store are going to be bad. One way to revive them and actually like bring them back to life is to char them or toast them really hard.
Yeah.
And so when you remove the liquid and they get like really crispy or they get the brown spots on the outside, they actually start to taste like toasted corn again. So that's something that's like one of the tricks that I do, especially if I have really, because a lot of the tortillas that are just sitting on the shelves in the grocery store have a lot of preservatives, and the preservatives have a very sour taste.
Yeah, that's exactly. A bit of a smell, right?
So, yeah.
You open them up.
Yeah.
And so if you throw them directly, if you throw the tortillas directly on your gas flame or on a grill.
On a gas flame. Sure.
So that the flame actually like touches them and you get little black marks. The black marks actually counter the sour taste of the preservatives.
Do you think it will work on the barbecue as well, if you put the tortillas on the barbecue?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I grill tortillas all the time.
That's a very good idea.
And actually, I think that's a really great way to kind of pretend like it's summertime, you know, so if it's snowing outside.
And, put the lights on.
You know, yeah, exactly. So you grill your tortillas and all of a sudden you're like, okay, I'm actually that's at the beach now. I'm not sitting in the snow.
Some other tips for tacos? For instance, the salsa, how to get them right or...
I think the salsas, I think that, you know, I think, again, people are scared to experiment. And I personally love putting fruit in my salsas. So if you substitute out either the tomatoes or the tomatillos for peaches or plums or pineapple or mango or papaya, or even just combine the two. So, you know, I've done watermelon salsas, and you can do watermelon and tomato, or tomatillos and papaya, or kiwi. You know, just have fun with it. You know, if you're going to use something really, really sweet, balance it out with a little tomatillo that has acidity
or a little bit of.
But I think, you know, doing that, I think can make your salsas more fun, and you can use the same basic recipe. The other thing that I tell people is, whenever I make salsa, I always make a lot of it, a lot more than I know I'm going to need, because it freezes very well. And so if I make a quart of, or let's say I make, a liter of salsa, I will probably save 250 mils for me to eat right now. And then I'll just put the rest of it in small containers and freeze it. And then that way, whenever I have a salsa emergency, like if I want to make breakfast tacos tomorrow and I'm like, oh my God, I have everything for the tacos, but not anything for the salsa. Yeah. I have salsa in the freezer and all I have to do is pull it out and let it thaw out.
That's a great idea. Also, because the tomatillo season here is quite short, and actually there you can get hold of them, but not easily.
The fresh ones, you mean?
Yeah. So I think that's a great idea.
And also in the freezer, the taste intensifies. It matures a bit more in the freezer. That's what I always have if you have dishes in there. So very good tips.
Very good tips.
Yeah.
In April this year, you launched a Borderline Salty podcast together with Carla Lally Music. Which we liked a lot.
Yeah, we listen to regularly. Yeah.
Regularly, we do. How was it received?
Oh, it's so loved. I mean, it's been amazing. Like, you know, just hearing from fans, hearing the comments, you know, also being, I think for me, what's so much fun is like the whole show, the whole premise of the show is about, you know, answering callers and answering real questions. And so to be able to not only ask people for questions, ask people for their nightmares or disasters or things that they want to learn, and then helping them through it. We had one episode where we loved it so much, we want to turn this into a segment. We had to solve a debate between a husband and a wife that were debating on whether, you know, raisins should exist in a meatball. And, you know, and it's just so much fun. So we completely loved it. And I think that, you know, and like your podcast, when you love what you do and you're passionate about it, people are attracted to that and they want more.
That's true. But it's not very easy, I would say. And you have to come up with ideas. It's more like more improvising, like you said before. You have to be right and you have to be correct. Was that difficult sometimes?
Not really. I mean, you know, I think, to be honest, like I think Carla preps a little more than I do. I'm the kind of person, like, if it's not already in my head, then I, like, whatever. Like, but I retain a lot of bizarre facts. So, like, I know the temperature, and I do a lot of baking, so I know, like, the temperatures for fermentation or, you know, just the wait times for things. And those numbers are just always in my head and always have been. So I can pretty much spit them out when I need to. I think when we record, we kind of forget that we're recording and we are literally just trying to make each other laugh.
Yeah, that's, what, so, that's what you hear when you listen to it. Yeah, yeah, that's what's nice of the podcast. Yeah,
sure.
When can we receive, when can we expect new episodes?
We will be starting to record again probably in the next few weeks. And so we're looking right now, we're trying to decide if it's going to be a before Christmas or an early January launch. But
pretty soon. Yeah. So, yeah, that's nice.
Very soon. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. We have something to look out for.
Yeah. Yes. I have one last question, Rick, and that's more or less the thing that we have encountered by doing a couple of episodes about Mexican food. We did Jeroen has a really nice dish, which is chili con carne.
Which is basically carne colorado, more or less.
Ah, then,
okay. Yeah, 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 yeah.
No beans, only
chili and meat.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
yay!
For us, it's that's also the nice thing about doing the podcast, doing the research, and learning more. But do you have could you have some tips to end our interview with you for the Dutch listeners who delve into the Mexican kitchen that they help them to start enjoying Mexican food?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's some basic techniques that I think are important, regardless of what ingredients you have. So, you know, you might not be able to source all the ingredients that are in the book, but I think that, you know, if you can make some reasonable substitutions, I think one thing that's really important is the weight of the dried chilies, because the dried chilies also provide the thickening power for the sauce. Yeah. So, And every chili is going to be a different size. So if and that's the reason why I put gram amounts in the book, because, you know, if my 6 chili anchos are probably going to weigh differently than your 6 chili anchos. Yeah. And so one of the most common comments or questions that I get is, I made your chili colorado and it's really thin or it's really, really thick. And it's like, okay, well, it's probably the chilies that you use. You know, you either used 5 really small ones or 5 really big ones. And so if you use the weight, the gram amount that I give you in the book, and you can even swap it out. If I called for anchos and you could only find guajillos, but I called for 27 grams, if you use 27 grams of whatever chili you can find, your sauce will be as thick as my sauce. And so I think that is super, super important. I also think that, you know, one of the fundamentals in flavor development in Mexican cuisine is charring and toasting and frying. And
the
so
vegetables, right?
A lot of my recipes, you'll see, you know, I wrote this like a million times. It's like line a cast iron skillet with foil, put it on high, and then roast your tomatoes, your onions, your chilies, you know, until they're charred on all sides. And that's like it makes such a difference. I actually made a soup, a sopa azteca, a few weeks ago. And I thought, I was trying to make it quickly. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to skip this step. The tomatoes were pretty good. They had decent flavor. So I was like, all right, I'm going to skip it and see if it works. And, it was just very flat. Like it was just completely flat. And, you know, and these techniques are done for a reason. And it's sort of like, imagine a cake without using vanilla, right? It might be a good cake, but it's missing something. You're going to taste it and think, this isn't right. It's not the way it should be. It's not as satisfying. And it's because there's that back note of charred vegetable, of charred chili, of smokiness. The color is going to be a little bit more dark brick red color. And so all of those things are going to contribute to sort of, you know, a much more true Mexican experience, I think.
So don't skip the charring, also not for the taco, for the tortillas themselves.
Yes.
Rick, thank you very much for your time. People can buy your book in the bookstore, and we would encourage everybody to do so and to delve into the Mexican cuisine, because it's fantastic and it's such a huge cuisine we just know just a little bit of. So thank you very much.
And thanks for whetting our appetite. It's 8 o'clock here, yes. So we're really, really hungry now.
Thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to being your tour guide to Mexico. Please come down and visit.
Oh, well, I'll write that down. Yeah. I'll write that down. And the same goes for Amsterdam. Whenever you're in Holland,
let us know.
Let us know.
I will definitely let you know.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Zo, dat is weer een mijlpaaltje. Een interview met iemand uit Mexico. En voor mij een vrij bekende chef die ik erg hoog heb zitten en graag naar luister en graag van kook.
Ja, ontzettend leuk om te doen. En ik ben ontzettend geïnspireerd om ook meer Mexicaanse keuken te gaan doen. En er geen podcast meer over te nemen.
Ja, dit was onze bonusaflevering. En volgende week hebben we gewoon weer een nieuwe reguliere aflevering.
Deze podcast wordt gemaakt door Jonas Nauwe en Jeroen Doucet.
Het team bestaat uit Corianne Straathof, Annie Tazelaar, Paul Veldkamp, Cato van Paddenburg en Jesse Burkunk.
En de muziek is gecomponeerd door Nico Bransen en Ton Dijkman en uitgevoerd door Mel en Vintage Future.
Tot de volgende keer.
Hasta la próxima.
Si.
Dat is de podcast. Yeah.